Good evening, friends. Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read, here, and indeed happy to welcome you to another edition of our program. And tonight, we're pleased to welcome an author we've had on many times. His name is C.B. Mosier, and he makes his home up in the foothill community of Mariposa. And by the way, he's a real physician. And that's what his story tonight is all about. How you get to be a real licensed medical doctor. He entitles this story, Med School Culture Shock. Here he is, C.B. Mosier reading, Med School Culture Shock.
Autumn in New York. Why does it seem so inviting? Autumn in New York. It spells the thrill of first nighting.
It all begins in the auditorium.
Look to your left,
the little man said to us from behind the podium. Twin snakes wound their way up the front of the pulpit toward him.
Look to your right,
he continued his command. All 128 of us swiveled our heads obediently, even though we knew what his third line would be. It was legendary, and we'd all heard it many times. He would say, one of the three of you will not graduate and become a doctor. The real message, of course, which neither the dean at the podium nor any of us in this medical school auditorium would say aloud was, work harder than you've ever worked before. Sacrifice sleep for study. Sacrifice your social lives. Sacrifice your marriages. Give your fellow students wrong answers. Learn not just the human body, but the entire medical library, and be able to regurgitate it all on command. But he was cute about it, this dean. After all, he'd heard the famous saying, too. He changed the third line.
All three of you should graduate and become physicians.
It should have been a relief, but he wasn't finished.
As long as you work harder than you've ever worked before and learn everything we have to teach you.
He smiled beneath his bald little head. Above the brass snakes entwining the staff of Caduceus on the podium and awaited our applause. He heard only silence. Our hands were frozen in terror. The underlying message, after all, had not changed. We congregated outside the auditorium as soon as we'd been released.
Hi, I'm John.
I responded to the stranger with my name. John added with a toothy smile, believe me, I'm going to make it to graduation. I felt a powerful urge to reveal my fears, but instead I just added, yep, me too. I'm going to be an internist like Kildare. We almost had a moment of optimism there, the two of us, but then this tall guy with an intensity burning on the verge of homicidal mania leaned into our conversation.
You two don't know what you're talking about.
And you do? Chirped John.
Yeah.
He pinned us to the wall with his eyes.
I do. I was here last year, right here. First year student and,
well, I interrupted him, you're here this year too, so you made it just fine.
Think so? He hissed. I'm not a second year student. I'm a first year student. Again. Along with eight others. They flunked us in physiology and we're repeating.
He bore in deeper with his eyes.
You only get one repeat. The sword of guillotine, of Dr. Guillotine, is hanging over our necks. Yours, too.
Damocles, I corrected him because it made me feel better somehow. Sword of Damocles. Well, chirped John with a broad smile, good luck this year. We'll see you in study hall. The tall guy slunk away into the milling group. It was autumn in New York. Beyond the dark paneled walls of the century-old medical school, trees were bursting into yellow and red and orange across the avenue in Central Park. "Come on," John offered. "Let's take a walk before classes start. Exercise is good." That afternoon felt like the last time that I saw trees as I dove into what should have been an exhilarating exploration of the world's second oldest profession, but was, because of this physiology thing, a tense blur of classes, labs, and library hours. In the evenings, I'd read my day's notes, outline them, reread them, then underline the important parts, which is to say, every line. I sunk into sleep when my eyelid muscles no longer had the endurance to remain open. In sleep, dreams were intertwined with nightmares. I see my father shaving at the mirror. He turns to me. No one speaks in dreams, but his eyes say what I always believe I'd heard years before. "You need to watch over your mother for a few days, son. I have to go to the hospital for a little test." Even in sleep, I feel my gut spasm at the words, "a little test." Behind the swirling curtains of another dream, I stand at my father's bedside. We're in a room of white walls, white sheets, white food on a white tray, served by an albino nurse. My father's face is turned away from me. I dread seeing it. Slowly he turns to look at me. My fear grows to terror. Will it be his death mask? Or worse, some surgically deformed visage of the father I love? "I'm fine," my father's smile tells me. "I'll be home tomorrow. They're taking real good care of me here." From that day, I was dedicated to being a performer of such miracles for others, a restorer of indestructible and indispensable fathers when their bodies betray them. But now, hovering above each dream scene, is the dark, gossamer threat of failure. I awake, all my muscles sore from the constant tension, to face another day, already hopelessly behind in my studying. Our body. The classical moment in a new medical student's life is when he, or she, more on that later, is introduced to his cadaver. My father once told me how my grandfather acquired his, with a shovel, apparently, at midnight, with a couple of other new medical students watching for the police while he and his lab partner dug as fast as they could. In New York in the late 1960s, it was much more civilized. Those who had donated their bodies to science hung in a chilled room, suspended with ice tongs by their ear holes. The school's technician removed them, placed them on the tables, and then covered them with plastic sheets. Then he leaned into a corner of the lab to watch as the new students slowly pulled back the sheet with all the bravery they could fake, smeared across their faces. "There's something wrong with his skin," I blurted. "Her skin," one of my dissecting partners corrected. "No breasts," I observed. "Mastectomies." He pointed to the dual scars with his steel dissecting probe. "It's the chemical that preserves them," Tom, our not-a-hair-out-of-place Ivy League third partner, said. "It turns their skin brownish." "Maybe it's natural," our fourth partner offered. "Like, you know, maybe she's Puerto Rican or Jamaican or something. Anyone know her name?" "We aren't told their real names," Mr. Professor of Medicine-to-be with perfect hair pontificated. "So we'll have to name her ourselves." "Let's not," I suggested. "Wow, look at all the scars on her abdomen. Hope the surgeon left enough parts for us to find." No one at our table gasped or puked. All the day's entertainment was three tables over. Over where the college football player and three other guys had yucked it up loudly, obnoxiously, before they pulled back the plastic sheet. Three of them were now staring at the body of the football player. Three guys in white coats at a medical school, looking down at their passed-out acquaintance, unsure what to do. We sure had a lot to learn. The Lion's Den. "Here we go," John said, taking an audibly deep breath. "Physiology lab." The specter of failing, as had the eight from last year, hovered over all of us like a plastic shroud that someone could drop on us at will. Groups of four were assigned to tables with anesthetized dogs who'd been unlucky enough to be strays. The physiology professor ordered us to do a dozen things that we'd never done before just to start the experiments. "Who's going to insert the catheter?" I asked my group, figuring if I asked first, somebody else would volunteer.
"You,"
barked a kid named Marshall. His face was stubbly with 3 days' growth, his hair curly and disorganized, his tie stained and askew. He made me think of that Frank Zappa guy. "Why me?" I asked. "I've never done this." "I'm attaching electrodes to this transducer here. You think I know what I'm doing? Look confident. The professor's watching." The room descended into murmurs and busy-looking, clueless elbows moving decisively within white coats. "This is awful," suddenly rang out. All eyes shut, not to the source of the outburst, but to the professor. He stood, clipboard in hand, white-coated, at a table near us and didn't flinch, didn't even look up. Just continued his instruction, getting ever nearer to finishing with that table and arriving at ours. As the murmuring took over again, I looked over at the student who had erupted. It was easy to find her. She was the tallest one in the room and blonde, a detail that all the guys had noticed since day one. "This poor animal," she followed up, disrupting the murmuring again. "Now that," whispered Murphy to the other three of us, "is why women don't belong in medical school." Something moved in our peripheral vision. All three of us dropped our eyes and our hands to the sleeping dog lying there, entangled in its net of wires and catheters. "What is the arterial pressure?" the professor asked us. Was the way I started. 90 millimeters. Zappa shot back in a voice that implied annoyance at the professor's intrusion. "Hurry up with the venous catheter," the professor ordered. "We have to begin the infusion." He was about to move to the next table when Murphy opened up. "Hey, did you hear that girl, professor?" he chuckled. "Pretty annoying, huh?" "Happens every year," the professor droned. "Women are different, which you should know, Mr. Murphy, since you're married." "How did you know that?" he reared back. "Shut up, Murph," I said to myself. "Shut up, Murph," Zappa shot from the corner of his mouth. "You think I don't read your files?" The professor raised his eyebrows. He fixed Murphy's eyes. "Loyola College." He turned to Zappa. "NYU. He looked at me. "Notre Dame." He finished with John. "Columbia. I expect good work from this table." Finally, he swiveled and moved on, and the three of us began to turn on Murphy, but the professor stopped and turned his head back toward us. "Oh, and Holly over there? She who annoyed you with her outburst?" We all hung in the silent moment. "Harvard." When the professor was out of earshot, John beat Zappa to the punch. "Nice work, Murphy. What were you trying to do? Kiss a little professorial butt?" "So, Marshall," I asked, my pen poised over our lab notes, "what was that arterial pressure again?" "I don't know," he snapped. "Make something up, like I did." And a sense of dread, like some onrushing cloud of radiation, began to engulf me. "My whole life will be fried to a useless crisp here, and I have no fallout shelter to run to." Histology.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, I get to use my microscope. We all flowed into histology lab, wooden boxes swinging from our arms. Fumble, fidget, plug it in, twirl the knobs, bounce excitedly on our stools.
It's a Bausch and Lomb 742,
boasted Dolan in response to someone's question, but loudly enough for the whole lab. He exuded both pride in his possession and cockiness that it alone would snag him an A like some magical biopsy tool. Somehow he managed to secrete all this enthusiasm from a face permanently fixed in a scowl. No one had seen a smile from him since day one in the auditorium.
You will break your fingers and the blood you will smear on the slide,
the histology professor directed.
Then find the corpuscles of all these different types.
He pointed to the board. Erythrocytes, basophils, neutrophils, platelets, macrophages, blasts.
Wow, I thought. I hope I find all of them.
Well, not the blasts. That would be weird. Diagnose your own leukemia? Ugh. So I swabbed my left index finger with the traditional alcohol, held it up before me, picked up a sharp little lancet in my right hand, took deadly aim, and jabbed. I missed. My index finger jerked back away from the arrow-like lancet. I snickered at myself. Well, it's just an issue of willpower. I planted my left elbow firmly on the counter, index finger pointing ceilingward, its vulnerable fleshy pad exposed to my focused pupils and to the poised lancet. I firmed the muscles in my left arm to hold it there, and before my left hand could suspect what I was doing, I lunged with my right. Missed again. Boy, my left hand is fast. Maybe if I... A hairy paw grabbed my left wrist and pushed my hand down flat onto the counter.
Now you will get your blood. You see, there is nowhere for your finger to go. Ouch!
Biochem. Sun, escaping the New York jungle of Central Park, shafted through the lab window and glinted off a Rube Goldberg cacophony of glass, test tubes, safety goggles, and Bunsen burners. Valves protruded from the backsplash of the counter, all aimed at me like enemy machine guns. They were labeled gas, water, oxygen, nitrogen, unknown. From this, I despaired, I'm supposed to recreate the Krebs cycle? Our livers had 30,000 years to figure it out, and I get 1 week? How's it going over there? The small guy to my left asked, kind of friendly. Some people are so quiet and innocuous you don't know they exist. Wire-rimmed glasses that made me unsure he actually wore glasses. A white button-down shirt, gray tie. All pretty boring, except for his hair, full, thick, and way past his ears, almost as far down as his sideburns. Oh, great, I chirped. Just fine. And you? Yeah, he smiled. I'm lost, too. A smile so natural it relaxed me just to look at it. You know, I think we're supposed to put this stuff in the Erlenmeyer flask and retort it into there, aren't we? He pointed at my Rube Goldberg, and I realized he was right. Huh. Why is he helping me? Ralph, he introduced himself. I introduced myself back, and naturally, comfortably, we became side-by-side lab partners in biochemistry. Everyone else sneered and cussed and faked their way through the afternoon, isolated from their neighbors. As I cookbooked my way through each step in our chemical mimicry of the human body's processes, the tune and words of Love Potion Number 9 came out of nowhere and cycled around in my brain. I couldn't dislodge it, so I commandeered it. I got a big old fear of physiology. The nasty old professor makes me shake and pee. I need something good to sneak into his wine. I'm gonna mix a flask of Love potion number 9. When the lab was over, Ralph smiled and dissolved again into the swirling background of medical school. That night, in the cafeteria, I asked my roommate if he knew this guy, Ralph.
"Oh, the short kid with long hair?"
he said as he straightened his tie in the glass of the cafeteria's dispensing machine. "He's weird, and not from here." "Not from here?" I sought clarification. He dropped coins into the machine.
"He's from out west somewhere."
"How far west?" I asked, self-conscious that I myself had gone to school in Indiana.
"You know, somewhere," he waved his hand as if chasing a fly. "The other side of the Hudson River. West."
"Oh, yeah," I mused. "Out there with the Indians and cannibals, right?" I expected either a guffaw or outrage at my sarcasm, but instead he just took his coffee from the horn and hard art dispensing machine and said, "Yeah, out there." Our isolation invaded. A few weeks into the first semester, with midterms looming like Godzilla over our little Manhattan Medical School, the bald dean took the podium again.
"Yesterday, some students,"
he almost spat this word,
"from this medical school walked down Fifth Avenue in a demonstration, a political demonstration."
We all glanced left, then right.
"Now I admit,"
he admitted,
"that you have the right to express yourselves, even when you're wrong, very wrong. But you do not have the right to wear the white coats with the school's insignia on it."
We were all looking only forward now, all looking innocent. Who would risk his medical school career doing that, I wondered.
"It was Ralph," John later told me as we all buzzed about it.
"Some anti-war demonstration downtown."
"That's a hell of a risk," I shook my head.
"No kidding. For the next 4 years, the only places you'll find me are in class, in lab, and in the library." That afternoon in biochem lab, I leaned toward Ralph and asked him.
"Yep, I was there. So were some other students and even some faculty," he added,
"and people from every other medical school in town."
"Aren't you afraid they'll throw you out? You're risking your entire career."
He looked at me for a long time with his easy, natural smile.
"Don't you think our involvement in Vietnam is immoral?"
I waited for him to say more, but he was done, apparently.
"That's for other people to decide," I said. "In Washington, my job right now is to get through medical school without flunking out or getting drafted."
"If you do get drafted, what will you do?"
"What do you mean, what will I do? It's not like I'd have a choice. They'd order me to go, and I'd have to go."
His smile, soft and gentle as it was, bore into me like a blowtorch.
"You don't have to do anything. You, all of us, choose what to do. Choose to support the war, or choose not to."
I snorted derisively. "As someone who cares about people's health, I've made my decision. Don't you think war is bad for people's health?"
"Sure," I snapped. "So's smoking. But I'm not going to quit until I graduate, and neither is anyone else. I need to get back to work."
From the corner of my flask-focused eyes, I watched Ralph carefully remove his jacket and slide into his lab coat.
Dylan. That's who he looks like. Bob Dylan.
Then my brain was assaulted by the times they are a-changin'. That really pissed me off.
"I don't care about changing times," my brain yelled silently. "And neither should any of us. Just study. Just become a doctor."
I tried to bump Dylan out with a different tune. "I said I'm gonna mix it up right here in the sink. I'll slip it in his wine to cover up the bad stink."
But Dylan wouldn't shut up, and it was all Ralph's fault. I felt a really powerful need for a Marlboro, but I was trapped here in the lab. I tried to fit a glass tube into a rubber stopper of a flask.
You'd better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone.
It wouldn't go in, so I pushed harder.
Don't criticize what you can't understand.
The glass tube snapped. The flask shattered. My Bunsen burner sizzled out.
A little frustrated, are we?
The professor's voice clawed against my neck like ice water. My impulse was to whirl, slash his face with the broken shard, and then to slit Ralph's throat.
The fact that I'm telling you this story is your clue that I did neither. I did something else. Or, more accurately, something else happened to me. I began to laugh. I realized it was inappropriate, but I couldn't quit. I slid to the floor, laughing so hard my abdominal muscles spasmed. I stumbled, still laughing, out of the lab, down the hall, into a bathroom. It took half an hour until I was able to stop it. A handful of my fellow students stood at the bathroom door looking down at me.
You okay?
I stood up, smoothed out what wrinkles I could in my lab coat, and said, Yeah, I feel better.
What caused that? John asked, very concerned.
I could imagine him calling the psychiatric unit. I don't know, I shook my head. Too much library, maybe? As finals approached, I called my parents to tell them that I wouldn't be home for Christmas, and I spent the holiday week in the library. If I'm going to flunk out of medical school, I confided to John, it's going to be this week. No need to worry about next semester.
Oh, you'll do fine, he said in his Pollyanna way.
He'd bolster anybody. He's probably going to be a great doctor. Just try not to do that laughing thing again, okay? The sun rose on January 6th. Now, that may not have been news to most of the world, but it was a major miracle in my life. And it helped me go a long way toward understanding that resurrection phenomenon the priests and nuns had been trying to explain to me. An 8.5 by 11 sheet on the bulletin board declared that I had, unbelievably, made the dean's list that first semester.
How'd you do?
Marshall asked me with his Zappa voice.
I passed, I said in a very long exhalation. Now I know I can do it.
And I went away, whistling. Four hadn't made it and were gone. That news spread quickly. I wonder if Ralph's one of them, I mused to John. He looked at me with a cocked eyebrow.
Why do you say that?
Well, if he's not downtown doing demonstrations, he's off at meetings about getting more black and minority students in medical school. He's not spending all of his time studying, you know?
John shook his head.
Straight A's, he pronounced. Dean's list.
So, I mused, maybe it pays to broaden your horizons.
Into the real. I signed up for a class on writing once a week downtown. If it ate into my studies, I could drop out, but meanwhile I was doing something other than medical school, a diversion. I was unaware that another diversion had already been planned into the medical school curriculum. A little man in a wool suit and a bow tie took the microphone.
I'm Dr. Botee, he began. Welcome to preventive medicine.
No one even tried to muffle their groans.
I know you aren't all that interested in preventive medicine right now. Snickers and snorts. But it's an important branch of the medical discipline. Guffaws. And to start the class off, we'll be doing a field trip. The buses will be here Friday at this time. It's not a vacation, so dress like professionals, he warned us. And no smoking on the bus.
Hand up.
Yes.
Where will we be going?
He smiled with his thin little lips. Harlem.
I was a little nervous about the field trip, and I could tell by the snippets of conversation that I wasn't alone.
Hey, my parents don't have insurance on me for death by gunshot, so make it look like an accident, okay?
I've never been this far north in Manhattan before. Does Santa Claus live in Harlem?
Out the left side windows of the bus, Central Park flowed by, green and sun-dappled. It morphed for me into a grassy hillside of long-ago bicycle summers, where I watched crows slowly circle on afternoons that felt like forever. A puff of breeze brought me the fleeting perfume of chlorophyll, the sound of buzzing insects, and a hint of cow poop. "Graze around me, cows," I murmured. And the rhythm of the bus tires became the cadence of "Grazing in the grass is a gas, can you dig it?" But unlike that long-ago forever afternoon, Central Park abandoned us at 110th Street. Brick apartment buildings gave way to empty lots and century-old tenements. The faces of the pedestrians outside changed color. We followed Dr. Bowtie off the bus. "These people have invited you into their homes." His eyes swept across all of us. "Be respectful."
"Homes? These are slums," Dolan sneered.
"Disrespectful," Ralph observed.
Dolan snorted.
Then Ralph added, "Unprofessional."
"Yeah, well, go back where you came from, weirdo. You don't belong in New York."
We followed Dr. Bowtie into the dank hallway, then climbed three flights of decaying stairs. We waited while the doctor knocked on the door. A black woman, small child on her hip, opened up.
"Mrs. Moore, these are the students. Thank you for letting us in."
"You're welcome, doctor. I just got back from the urgency room. My boy done got his finger bit off."
"Bit off?"
Bowtie sought clarification as we squeezed into her dark apartment. Three mattresses on a floor of peeling linoleum. Trash heaped up in the corners. Filthy windows admitted little light.
"Grayson,"
she called. A boy, maybe 4 years old, ran over to her and grabbed her skirt with a bandaged hand. He peered up at us in fear. The rest of us stepped back, slowly, trying to dissolve our white faces into the shadows. All except Ralph. He squatted down to Grayson's level.
"Hi," he smiled at the boy. "I'm Ralph. What's wrong with your hand?"
The boy held up his white bandage.
"Did you hurt your finger?"
Ralph continued, softly, his voice a pitch higher than normal.
"You bit me,"
the boy mumbled.
"Oh, I'm sorry,"
Ralph soothed him.
"Who bit you?" "The rat."
"Rat?"
"Last night, I was sleeping."
"Oh, I see.
Well, where do you sleep? Can you show me?"
And Grayson let go of his mother to run over to one of the mattresses, stand beside it proudly, and declare,
"This one, mine."
Ralph walked over, squatted down to look closer at the mattress on the floor.
"What a nice bed you have," he praised the boy. "Do you help your mother by making the bed?"
"Ain't no bed," Grayson educated him.
"It's a mattress."
Later, as we boarded the bus, I heard Dolan's familiar sneer as he passed Ralph.
"What a nice bed, fairy."
I made a point of catching up to Ralph in the corridor of the school. "Sorry about what Dolan said." He shrugged. "That's his problem. I feel sorry for him."
"You do? You're the only one in class, then."
"Really? That's sad."
"Where are you from?"
I took the most direct path to answer this enigma. "A little town near San Francisco. Why?"
"You seem more, relaxed, doing stuff, you know, other than studying, as if you were, I don't know.
"Mellow?" he offered.
"More laid back?"
"I don't know what that means." He just smiled.
So what's your specialty going to be?"
I veered the discussion for my own comfort. "Preventive medicine?"
"Pediatrics, but now that you mention it, peds is pretty close to preventive medicine."
"You?"
"Internal medicine."
I fear I may have puffed out my chest a little bit.
I'm going to be a diagnostician, a detective. Preventive medicine's definitely not for me. I hate bow ties. I braced for an argument. Good. Do what feels right for you. That way you'll really be into it. But for me, I'd rather prevent illness than clean up after it. I was briefly speechless. The whole purpose, after all, of going through the torture of medical school, of becoming a doctor, was to treat sick people. Well people don't need physicians. When I did respond, it wasn't too clever. Bull, I said. Smile to laugh to smile again. You ever see a kid with a finger bitten off by a rat before? I held my hands out, palms up. No, me neither. Now, what was the cause, the etiology of that disease? Rat, I smirked. Nope, it was poverty. It wouldn't happen in our homes, huh? Oh, I get it. You're going to cure poverty. I lost control of my sarcasm. No, he spoke quietly, gently. Poverty and war. Aha! I exhaled my satisfaction at finally fitting one piece of this puzzle neatly into its vacancy. So that's why you're against this war. He shook his head. Against all war. It's just logical. I can't imagine any physician thinking otherwise. Home stretch. I dove back into my books and labs, trying to focus on learning how illness reveals itself in our bodies. Within a year, I was presented with a new terror, the requirement that I introduce myself to a real patient and find the illness hiding in his body. As I took the next frightening steps over the remaining years of medical school, those of applying treatment to the diagnosed illness, I found myself haunted, plagued by the memory of rat-amputated fingers and by continuous TV images of amputated everythings. I slowly began to notice how the diseases I diagnosed and tried to treat were different from those that we had learned in the books. Cancer in smokers, heart attacks in couch potatoes, strokes in overweight people, trauma in drunk drivers, overdoses of drugs. These diseases, unlike those in the texts, were self-inflicted. These diseases, Ralph would have told me had I asked him, were preventable. When, during my final year, an opportunity arose to work in a clinic in South America, for some reason, I took it. "Why down there?" John asked. "You want to be Dr. Schweitzer instead of Dr. Kildare?" "Diagnosticians need to know tropical diseases, too," was the best explanation I could mount. I applied for internship in California. "Why California?" John asked again. "We have plenty of good hospitals here." That was a little harder to answer. The best I could come up with was, "The times, they are a-changin'."
Mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing.
That was C.B. Mosier reading Med School Culture Shock. And so, after finding out what med school is all about from a man who's actually a real physician, are you still eager to become a doctor? Are you still willing to give up just about all of your regular private life to attend what appear to be extremely difficult classes and study in the library just about all night long? Our author subjects us to some real shock therapy when he introduces us to what it's really like to take all those medical lab classes, including working with those cold cadavers. And don't forget that if you flunk out on your first year, are you willing to try over again from the very beginning, like some of the students that we heard about tonight? And then on to more biology, chemistry, and preventive medicine, not to mention residences in various hospitals, all of it so you can finally earn your degree and become a real licensed medical doctor. Well, what we heard about tonight was a tough, well-written story that surely would make anybody think twice before attempting to become a physician, especially nowadays when the price of going to school is so high. Friends, we've had Dr. C.B. Mosier on quite a few times. He's currently a public health physician up in the foothill community of Mariposa. In the past, he's lived in South America, camped in the snows up in the Sierra, and even practiced medicine in Haiti. An avid writer, he has published stories and novels, and besides his professional duties, teaches a class in short story writing in his community. We certainly thank him for his contribution tonight, and hope he'll be submitting more stories to our program in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read program again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Burley Vang. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story. Until we meet again, good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.